9/11, it's more than just the emergency telephone number today. Today it represents a day that is scarred by terror, that is imbrued with blood. On that very day, the world became New York City. New York City became the world. It was a symbol, it is now a symbol of unity in the midst of diversity, of tenacity in the midst of vulnerability, and of hope in the midst of devastation. Since that day, Islam as a religion has been scrutinized and vilified and harmonized and deified and all other kind of fied words you can add in here. Books, newspaper reports, magazine articles, news reports on the television, political speeches have been published and presented, some exonerating Islam of any blame in the 9/11 attacks. Others placing complete and total blame on Islam. And I think between all the sophistry and the rhetoric and the truths about what is going on in our state today, in our country today, and yeah, even in our world today, that we can find one thing that is crystal clear. The fact that Islam is an enigma. That it's a puzzle that no one seems to be able to put together. And that's why I'm thankful to be here today, to be part of this program that looks at Islam and looking for true Islam, which some say can never be found. But I believe that's what we're here to do. We're here to investigate this religion against the religion of God, against the true religion which God established and ordained and expects for all mankind to follow today, regardless of their geographical location on this world. God expects all men to be Christians today. The fact is, we have many world religions, and it's good for Christians, those who are seeking to know what God's will is, it is good for them to go back and search these other world religions and see where they stand in the grand scheme of things, see what it is they have against Christianity, against God, and against His Word. And so what we see is that Islam itself is against God, but we need to be looking at Islam. And the more we look, the harder we look, the harder we search, it seems the more puzzling Islam becomes as a religion. From Christians seeking to convert their Muslim peers to reporters on television trying to understand Muslim peace, as it is often referred to even adherents of the religion itself desiring justification for the actions that are done by others of their same religion. It's just a puzzle, and no one seems to be able to put it together. Fareed Zechariah, in trying to harmonize what has happened on September 11th with Islamic traditions and Islamic religions throughout the world, makes this statement: nothing will be solved by searching for true Islam or quoting the Quran. Here's a Muslim. And pray tell me, brethren, how in the world are we going to find out what Islam is about if we can't go to the very book that defines, identifies, and separates Islam as religion? I mean, he's telling us, basically, he follows a religion whose holy book cannot be relied upon to describe the religion he follows. I believe I would be distraught if I could not go to the Bible and prove what Christianity was true. But here's a man who feels nothing, no qualm about stating that. He says nothing, not a little, but nothing will be solved by searching for true Islam or by quoting the Quran. The Quran is a vast, vague book filled with poetry and contradictions. And then here he gets his little stab in, much like the Bible. I beg to differ there, obviously. The Bible is not vast, it is not vague, and it is not filled with contradictions. Some might say, well, look at that, that's a thick book. What was it John said? If we were to write all the works of Jesus Christ in the book, the world could not contain. You want to talk about a vast book? That would have been a vast book. This is a brief summary of the actions of God from the creation of the world to the present day. That's all it is, a brief summary. Vast, no. Vague, no. It's very specific in a lot of places, in most of the places. Very detailed in its accounts of history. But he says that the book of Islam is vast. It is vast. You start reading it and you find a lot of redundancy, a lot of things that don't make sense. They contradict one another from not just from one half of the book to the other half, but from one page to the next page, and oftentimes from one line to the very next line, we find contradictions. He goes on to say you can find it in condemnation of war, and you can find in it incitements to struggle. It condemns war and it condones war, he says. It's beautiful expressions of tolerance and stern strictures against unbelievers. We can tolerate unbelievers sometimes. Sometimes we've got to kill unbelievers. You're beginning to see the vagueness of the book, aren't you? Some of the contradictions that are found within their holy scriptures. Quotations from it tell more about the person who selects the passage than about Islam itself. In other words, if I go to the book and of Quran and I quote from it a passage that talks about how they are to slaughter and kill infidels, that reveals to you more about me than it does about the religion itself. Which does not make sense. Which illustrates the very contradictions he's talking about. Then he goes on to say this. Every religion is compatible with the best and the worst of humankind. Through its long history, Christianity, you knew he couldn't get very far without condemning Christianity, through its long history, Christianity has supported inquisitions and anti-Semitism, but also human rights and social welfare. And he's trying to put it into the category that both religions, Islam and Christianity, are both filled with vagueness, that are both filled with contradictions. Just as Islam condemns war and sometimes tells us to fight a war, he says the same thing is true with Christianity. Sometimes Christianity is, for example, it supports the inquisitions and the anti-Semitism, and at the same time it also supports the social welfare and the human rights. Which, by nature, those four things are contradictory to one another. But what Zechariah and others who are trying to prove the condemnation or prove that Islam is a peaceful religion, what they don't understand is that the inquisitions and the anti-Semitism that they think they see in Christianity as being justified by the Bible has never been justified by the Bible. Anti-Semitism is opposing Jews by race, not religion. Anti-Semitism is looking at the race of the person and opposing him because he is a Jew. I don't oppose Jews because they're Jews. In fact, in my heart's desire, like Paul's desire, was that the house of Israel be saved. That every single living Jew today obey the gospel of Jesus Christ and go to glory. Just like it is my hope that every practicing Muslim today will repent of their false religion, adhere to Christianity, and have a home in heaven. Because it's offered to every single one of us. What Zechariah has done is he's tried to take Islam and surgically attach it to God as if somehow doing so is going to justify his position. And many Islamic apologists have sought to do the same thing by justifying Muslims by ridiculing Christianity and Judaism. That's a fact. The idea is if we can show how bad Christianity is, if we can show how bad Judaism really is, then Muslims and Islam doesn't look near as bad as it once did. Such comparisons are simply false. And I believe one of the worst comparisons is this one that we're looking at this morning, which is by comparing the opposed or the atrocities of the Old Testament with the atrocities of Islam. As if somehow that justifies the terrorist acts that are going on today. Now, when we start looking at such comparisons, it's often accepted to begin with that Islam produces atrocities. You notice whenever someone starts asking those questions, Wayne, about, why is it that Islam does these things? And they always go and they say, well, it's the same thing they did in the Bible. Notice they never try to say Islam does not really commit atrocities, do they? They can't. In recorded history, there's way too much evidence to show that the Islamic religion is full of terrorism and full of atrocities. Full of death. 9/11, the attacks on the World Trade Centers in New York was only the most recent pinnacle at that time, even, of Islamic terrorism. It headed a list that was long and bloody. In the book, there's several statistics there that were come up or that were written about in the New York Post back in September of 2002 by a fellow by the name of Daniel Pipes. You can actually go, and I believe that the web address is there. You can go and read his list. But I have a few of it here, but attacks against U.S. citizens on foreign soils during the early 80s. Over 300 people were killed. Why? They were murderers, right? They were the most vile and wretched people of the world, right? No, they were murdered because the Islamic world didn't like them, period. They killed them, slaughtered them. There was a time of relative peace toward the mid and late 80s, but then, come back into the 90s, especially the late 90s, another 300 people are killed. Then he even has a list of people who were killed on U.S. soil, simply because they're not Muslim, because they're not Islam, because they're not what these people, these different sects of the Islamic religion expect them to be. The list that Pipe has is direct, those that are directly linked to the Muslim world and Muslim extremists. It does not include attacks which appear to be linked to Islam but cannot be proven. Just those that have been directly linked. Those Islamic followers responsible for the death and the destruction, get this, they gladly accept responsibility. It was less than 2 weeks ago, or I assume around 2 weeks ago, that we had the bombing of the bus in Jerusalem. And the scenes and the pictures of that the news report showed were of, you know, children who were dead and laying out in the streets and adults that were mangled in pieces all over the place. And it was a gruesome, gruesome sight. And within 4 hours of attacks, two Islamic extremist groups were claiming responsibility. They were fighting over who gets credit for such atrocities as just been committed. Isn't that sick? That someone in the world was so proud of the death and the destruction and the heartache and the sorrow caused by that bomb that they fought over who got to claim credit. Here we sit in McLeod, Oklahoma, and we don't understand that mindset, do we? That is completely foreign to us. Even if we didn't like the people, we don't wish upon someone such a gruesome act as death by the hundreds and the thousands, do we? And yet that's exactly what they've done to us. So when you start talking about the atrocities of Islam, they're all too glad to tell you, yeah, there's a lot of atrocities. No one questions whether or not they're doing it. Everyone understands and knows and accepts the fact that Islamic extremists, as they're called by their own people sometimes, which I don't think they're quite so extreme, but these Muslims, the Islamic followers, are glad to do the atrocities that are committed. And then they turn around and they say, you know, but that's just like what happens in the Old Testament. Is that true? Central to this comparison is the idea that the Old Testament is replete with stories of atrocities, of atrocities and actions that are condoned by God. But when you start looking at these atrocities, when you start looking at these events of war and destruction and death, you find two things, two types of events are going on here. First are those things which are sanctioned by God for punishment of a specific deed. Sometimes you find that. And other times when you see such atrocious acts in the New Testament or in the Old Testament, they're acts which are unsanctioned by God that He does not endorse. Certainly, whenever you're looking at these atrocious actions, you need to understand which one are you looking at. Does this one fall under the kind which God is sanctioning, or does it fall under the kind in which God does not sanction? And obviously, if it falls under the kind which God does not sanction, and you compare that to Islamic atrocities, then you make no gain of ground here. God condemns both. Both are unjustified in the sight of God. So what we want to do is we want to look through the Old Testament, just a brief history of the Old Testament. We don't have time to look at every single atrocity of the Old Testament. There's a lot of times in which wars are fought and people die. We understand that. We know that. But we want to do so by asking three questions. First, we're going to ask the question, did God command the action to be taken? If not, then that example cannot be used as evidence that Islamic terrorism compares to the so-called Judeo-Christian terrorism, because it was not prompted by God. That was terrorism, pure and simple, because some man or some group of men decided to go against another group of people and destroy them. The first account that comes to mind comes in Genesis chapter 34, in which the sons of Jacob decide to avenge the defiling of their sister Dinah. And they destroy the men of an entire city sanctioned by God. I don't think you can find in the text that it was sanctioned by God. This was human devised and human executed. So you must ask that first question, did God command it? If God did command it, the next question is, did He have a justifiable reason for commanding it? Is there something behind it? You know, God does everything for a reason. I mean, it's a justifiable reason. And oftentimes it's there simply to show the justice and the righteousness of God. When abominations are committed, God's justice, God's righteousness requires Him to execute punishment. That's all there is to it. If something is wicked and abominable, God must punish it. In the Old Testament, oftentimes it was punished directly. And under the New Testament, oftentimes we suffer the consequences of what we do, or the consequence of our abomination, but the ultimate punishment will not come until that day of judgment. But that's important when we're looking at Islam, their atrocities. And let me just make a note here that conversion was never, ever a justifiable reason for bloodshed. God never commissioned, not in the Old Testament, not in the New Testament, He never commissioned His children to convert with the edge of the sword or at the point of a gun or the thumb under, or the button under the thumb of a dictator. Never did He choose that. It was always people who willingly submitted to His will. Free submission, not forced submission. And then third question we're going to ask is, if the reason is justifiable, if it is God commanded and it is justified by the New Testament and the Old Testament scriptures, then is the reason for it happening the same as the reason for the Islamic terrorism? And oftentimes you'll find that if it gets past the first two questions, it won't get past the third one. In fact, it never gets past the third one, because the reasons cannot be the same. If the reasoning is not the same, then these actions, once again, cannot be compared to the actions of the Old Testament. Let's start with the patriarchy. And Genesis chapter 14 records one of the first major conflicts. And this is when the King Chedorlaomer and those who were with him come against the cities of Sodom in the plains. And they capture Lot. And they're carrying him off as spoils of war. And Abraham takes his fighting men, his servants, and all those who are under his command, and they go and they fight against the kings of the plain in order to rescue Lot. And in so doing, they are victorious. And no doubt in so doing, they killed some people. This is a battle. And battles often wind up with people dead. God did not at the very beginning sanction Abraham to go and do these things, but I believe in Genesis chapter 14, verses 18 through 24, when on his way back, he meets up with Melchizedek, who is a high priest of God, and he receives the blessings from Melchizedek. That shows us that God did in fact approve of Abraham's actions, that he was justified in seeking to rescue Lot from the villainous kings. Muslims' actions do not compare to this, however, because while they would go and maybe try to free a terrorist who has been imprisoned, and so they think that, well, we're trying to free our comrade in arms. They go in, they kill a bunch of people, they rescue their prisoners, and they go off. The fact is, those people are not innocent of people's blood. They're terrorists. That's why they're in prison. They have killed innocent people. There is blood on their hands, and they deserve the punishment they are receiving. With Lot, it wasn't that way. Lot was an innocent man. He was simply a citizen in that area, and they captured him and took him away. We have no indication there was blood on Lot's hands. We have no indication that he'd shed innocent blood, or that he'd killed these people, or that he was being punished for anything other than the fact that he was a citizen of that region. So you can't compare those two. One is trying to rescue maybe these terrorists full of blood. The other is trying to rescue an innocent man. God sanctions the rescue of innocent Lot, but he certainly would not sanction the rescuing or the capturing of those who deserve the punishment they're in. The next one we find is in Exodus 14. The next one we'll look at is Exodus 14, in which Moses is commissioned by God to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt. They cross through the Red Sea, and we're told in Exodus 14, verse 26, the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch your hand over the sea that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots, and on their horsemen." You know what God is telling him? He's saying, you lead those Egyptians, you lead the people through the water, you get on the other side, you stretch out your hands, the water will come back again, and what's going to happen? But the Egyptian army is going to be destroyed. Is that atrocious? Absolutely, that's atrocious. It's atrocious that Pharaoh abused these people under his command. It's atrocious that when God sent Moses to Pharaoh, Pharaoh refused to let them go. It's atrocious that when Pharaoh said, "Yes, you go ahead and leave," that he changed his mind and came after them. The atrocity is not in the fact that the waters have come back together and destroyed the Egyptian army. The atrocities are on the part of Pharaoh, not God. That's the atrocious nature of what was going on during that time. As we go a little further and we go into the next Bible period, we look at the period of the conquest. Certainly there's much bloodshed in the period of the conquest. The book of Joshua, they're going to drive out the children or the inhabitants of the land of Palestine. There's a plan that is given in Joshua chapter 6 and verse 17. God says, "Now the city shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction, and it and all who are in it." Every single one. In compliance, Joshua's army, it tells us in verse 21, utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, ox and sheep, donkey, and he did so with the edge of the sword. This was the pattern that Joshua followed for his central campaign, for his southern campaign, for the northern campaign throughout the first 10, 12 chapters of the book of Joshua. His military deeds followed the plan of the military the strategy established by God Himself. God told them, "This is how you're going to do it." And He told Moses all the way back in Deuteronomy chapter 20. And notice in that passage in Deuteronomy chapter 20, God distinguishes between those which were cities of Palestine and those which were cities outside the land of Palestine. Why? Because God appointed Joshua to destroy the ones that were in Palestine. He had no business going outside of the land which had been promised to the children of Israel. And Joshua, if he was going to be successful at all, he had to do exactly what God commanded. And we read those passages, man and woman, young and old, child, infant. And to some this may seem barbarous and unpalatable, but God gave the reason. He had a reason for it, a justifiable reason. In Deuteronomy 20, verse 18, he says, "Lest they teach you to do according to their abominations, which they have done for their gods, and you sin against the Lord your God." He is punishing them for their abominations, specifically. And trying to keep their abominations from tainting the children of Israel, and in other passages, from tainting their own children even, to commit the same abominations that they themselves were committing. Thus God justly destroyed those nations, saving them from adding to their sins. I get that. Had they lived any longer, they would have added to their sins and their abomination before God. They would have trained another generation to add to their sins and their abominations before God. God, by punishing them through destruction, actually saved them from adding any more to their sins. Saved their children so that they would not grow up in those abominations. This does not parallel, because we do not inhabit the lands of the Muslim, do we? We're not trying to force some abomination upon them. In fact, if anything, as Wayne has mentioned, our government and our people are going so far the other way to make accommodations for the Islamic religion all around the United States. If there's any inkling that we're trying to force upon them some religion other than that which they wish to practice, I have not seen it. You have not seen it. Our government has not seen it. And most people throughout the world has not seen it. It's simply not there. But what about the book of Judges? What is the book of Judges? But in Judges chapter 2, verses 11 through 20, tells us that it's this repetitious cycle, isn't it? It starts with the people who are at peace, and then they, through their sin, they fall into oppression. And in their oppression, they cry out to God, and God raises up a judge and delivers them. And how does He deliver them? Through battle, through war, through blood. They are delivered. And that cycle repeats itself time and time and time again. But notice, most of those battles involve who? The mighty men of valor. Those who have chosen to be in the army and go to war. Is Islamic terrorism likened to war? You know, that's one of the strangest parts about our current war, is a war on terrorism. How do you fight terror? That's the question. That's what a lot of people have been asking. How do you fight terrorism? Because terrorism, by nature, is not war. It's covert, it's secret, it's trying to instill and inflict in people a fear of what is going on. And certainly they do a good job of that. How long was our airline shut down? How often do we turn on the television to find out what our terror alert status is? If it's orange or yellow or possibly even red today? Is that the same as fighting with mighty men of valor? No, not at all. Not in the least. Was God justified in allowing these judges to deliver them? Certainly. One in particular, look at the life of Samson. Here is Samson, and at the end of his life, he is brought low, he's humiliated. He's in the house of Dagon at this festival, and they're going against him. He's blind, he has no strength in him, and he begs God, give me just one more burst of strength. Remember me now. And he remembers him, and he pushes down the pillars, and remember it says that the temple caved in on itself. So that the number he destroyed in his death was greater than those that he destroyed even in his life. Was God justified in allowing Samson to destroy those men and women? Certainly. The men and women killed were engaged in false idol worship at the very instant of their death, and they were making a spectacle of God. Think about that. They were humiliating a man of God. They had him in chains. They had him humiliated. They had him brought low. They were making a spectacle of Jehovah. And the justice of God simply demanded that the people be judged and punished. And so through this man, Samson, God meted out his punishment to those who were in false worship. Is that the same thing as Islamic terrorism? No, it's not. We can go on and on. I believe I'm running out of time. So I want to skip forward. We can look at the kings with the destruction of Amalek. In 1 Samuel chapter 15, they were to destroy everything, men, women, and child. But here again, it was promised by God beforehand. He told them when they came out of the land of Egypt, they were attacked by the Amalekites through the power of God. And Moses, with Moses raising his hands, they were able to eventually defeat the Amalekites. But God vowed that day that he was going to come back and meet judgment upon them. And so through Saul, the king, when they were powerful again, he went against the Amalekites and he meted out the punishment, the judgment that God said he would do, exactly as it was promised. But let's look for just a moment about why these two types of atrocities cannot be compared. Look at several reasons why they cannot be the same. Even though historians and politicians, theologians, they demonstrate great ignorance in attempting to justify Islamic terrorism by saying that it is the same as God's retribution using Old Testament Israel. It's simply not the case. The two extremes cannot be harmonized. You cannot bring them together and say they're one and the same. First and foremost, reason number one, get this, if you're making notes, these are the notes you definitely want to take down. It's a false religion. I could end right there. It's a false religion. Because any time a law tells a Muslim to go and commit such an atrocity, we know that it's a lie. Because a law does not exist, because the religion of Islam is not real, and because this is a man-made fantasy. Anytime we are following a man-made religion and a man-made fantasy, we are going to be wrong. Okay? It's a false religion. Therefore, following God, while it's always going to be right, following false God is always going to be wrong. Sadly, most people don't agree with that. Well, you know, all religions, they're all equal. We need to say accept every one of them and be tolerant of everything that's going on. No, we don't. And ironically, I don't think there's a religion out there that believes that. I think every one of them believes itself to be right. It's just that they have given up on their principles. Something that Christians need not ever do. Second reason, they cannot be compared. God always had a specific reason for His punishment. When He told Joshua to go into the land, it was, you go in there, you defeat the cities of Palestine, and that's it. When He told Jehu that He was supposed to kill Ahab and his dynasty, that's all He had the authority to kill. When He told Saul to defeat the Amalekites, it was the Amalekites that were the target. It was very specific. It was a specific people for a specific purpose, in a specific way, in a specific location, a specific time, everything like that. What do you get when you come to the Islamic religion? Kill all unbelievers. It's very generic. It's very vague. As Farid himself, Farid Zechariah, actually said that it is a vast and vague book. And the commands that are found are vast and vague. And I have several quotes from the Quran there. And you can see the vagueness of it. There's no specificity at all. It's not a specific people for a specific person, for a purpose at a specific time. It's just anytime you meet the infidel, kill them. And then other times, it's anytime you meet the infidel, tolerate them. There's your contradictions again. Aberration. People cite Old Testament passages and say, well, you know, the ones that were an aberration against God, they were against the sanction of God. Or even, you know, citing Christianity as Zechariah did in our particular quote here, where he says that Christianity supported, what, inquisitions and anti-Semitism. Those are aberrations to Christianity. God and Christ never sanctioned the Spanish Inquisitions. They never sanctioned the Crusades. They never sanctioned war of any kind like that, ever. And when people try to put Christianity's name on things like the Crusades, that's an aberration to God Himself. And yet, when you go to the Islamic parts, the aberration is not doing that. It's the very opposite. When they don't kill the infidel, when they don't slaughter innocent people, that's the aberration. And you get see all these celebrities get up telling us that Islam is a religion of peace. That's the aberration. Judgment. God is judging punishment upon those who have committed abominations before Him. Whether they're Jew or not. That's what's amazing is in the Old Testament, some of the atrocities are not the Jews going against other nations. It's the other nations that come in a war against the Jews. You will never find in the Quran where it sanctions the infidel or the non-Muslim to come against the Muslim to punish them. Because by the virtue of the fact they're Muslim, they must be right. And yet in the Old Testament and even in the New Testament, just because one is called a Christian and one is called a Jew does not necessarily make them right. And oftentimes they were in the wrong. And God punished them. And the very things that they say, you know, well, you know, that's atrocious. It's not atrocious. It's the very judgment and justice of God. Look at Jonah. What happened with Jonah? He gets in his ship to go to Tarshish instead of going to Nineveh. The great storm rages. He goes to who? The Gentile captain of the ship. And the Gentile crew. And he says, this storm is hitting you. Not because you're a Gentile. Not because you're an unbeliever. Not because you're an infidel. It's hitting you because of me. They didn't even want him to throw him overboard. But when they eventually did, the storm was stayed. God saved the infidel. Didn't He? Go to the next chapter. He goes to Nineveh. He preaches to them about morality, about the judgment that was to come. They repented. They were Gentiles. They were infidels. And they repented. God forgave them. And then finally, their view of the infidel altogether. To the Islam, the non-Muslim is simply cordwood for the fires of hell. You got to have something to fuel those fires for an eternity. Well, let's pick the bodies and the souls of those who are not Muslims. There is no value there. There is no hope there. They're non-Muslim. But notice the value of the non-Christian. God tells us you go into all the world and you preach the gospel to every living creature. Why? Because every soul is precious. God is not just interested in our souls as we sit here as Christians, as brothers and sisters. He's interested in every soul that's out here. And He views them with the same value and the same desire to have and to hold. Islam doesn't put that value on the infidel. But God does. He wants even the most wretched, vile sinner saved. And He gives us the opportunity and the time to go to them and reach them with this gospel. Islam constitutes a major religion upon this earth. Certainly, as Christians, we must respect the Muslim souls because we want them saved. But we are not obliged by God to accept their religion or their ways of terror. And while the world paints with a broad brush and tries to tie the actions of the Muslim to the actions of the Jew or the Christian and put them together, such comparisons simply are not justified. In fact, they're deceptive. Old Testament Judaism, New Testament Christianity are vastly different from modern Islam. And it is foolishness for the Islamic apologists to defend their actions based upon supposed similar actions in the Bible and the Judeo-Christian history. Nowhere in the Bible, Old Testament or New, can one find justification for September 11, 2001? Defenders of terror are forced to look elsewhere for justification, and they will never find it in the sight of God.